session number 23818, Reel 1.
Commander Christopher Eason, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Commander Eason?
Yes, I was born in Southsea on the 14th of December 1923. I was the youngest child of three of the then commander Victor Eason, a paymaster commander, and Violet Eason, elder sister Barbara has just died, this is 2002, elder brother Peter, who's also in the Navy, died about 10 years ago.
Could you tell us a little about your childhood and sort of yes. The influence of your father's naval career, perhaps?
Yes, I suppose the biggest naval influence in our family was my grandfather, who was very well known, Henry Eason, who entered the Navy as a boy, seaman, at the age of about 15, I suppose, at Portland, and became the very first rating to hold a commission in the newly created signal branch. From childhood, as you can understand, it was a very naval family. Grandfather, father, elder brother, all in the Navy. I don't remember my grandfather at all, though we did overlap just by a couple of years. Father was nearly always at sea, as was common in those days. Educated in a quite conventional way, a little prep school called Soberton Towers in Hampshire. From there, passed into Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, at the age of 13. Emerged.
That we're quite interested in Dartmouth. So can we talk a bit about Dartmouth and your training there?
Mm-hmm.
You were 13, so you'd go there in about 1936, I presume, or possibly into
37. I think it was 37.
Could you just outline the setup at Dartmouth and how the training was organised at the time?
We entered in batches of about 40, which we called terms. So there was... they entered about every three or four months as the school terms were organised. And then, while I was there, the what was called the term system changed a little, and after two terms in the sort of initial entry bunch, we moved into houses which contained cadets of all ages at Dartmouth from maybe about 14 then up to 17 when they left.
What was your living accommodation like, your dormitories?
Spartan, but quite satisfactory. One house would occupy a pair of dormitories, very long, thin rooms. Your bed, at the end of which was your chest, the real old sea chest like everybody had in those days, that was all. Service by retired Royal Marines. I think they were mostly bandsmen. And they also were in the college. They made the college band for parade purposes. And once or twice a week, they turned out a dance band, like they could do now. The routine was rigid, and sort of Spartan to normal, not in any way inhumane. Discipline was maintained largely by the cadet captains, who were themselves cadets. The older boys in their last year would a selection of each term would be promoted to cadet captains, and they actually ran the houses.
How did they maintain discipline, would you say? I mean,
mainly purely by their own authority. There was no great problem. I mean, we were kept very busy, and after all, we were volunteers for our disciplined service in the first place. There's also a house officer who's a lieutenant, usually quite a young lieutenant. In my case, it was, first of all, Ian McKendrick, and then a fairly famous officer called Sellers, Lieutenant Commander Monkey Sellers, who was famous because he was a great rugby player in those days. But that was as with the coming of the war, people like McKendrick were required at sea, and the older men are possibly not going to see any sea service were brought in for that kind of job.
And what sort of punishments would they wield? I realise there wasn't much trouble, but
the punishments, they ranged from purely sort of rather pathetic kind of exercises. If you hadn't folded up your shirts properly, you might be ordered to go down and run twice round the parade ground and come back again. That kind of public school kind of thing, you know. There was still a little corporal punishment, beating with the cane, but very, very sparsely administered. Very sparsely indeed. But the one thing which invoked immediate wrath of God, of course, was any suggestion of homosexuality. And if that happened, and there would have been perhaps sort of one or two cases a year in the whole college, boys were inclined that way, and it became known, they were out before their little feet touched the ground. Possibly via a rather nasty punishment called official cuts, which was administered in the gymnasium, bent over a vaulting horse, and you were beaten by Marine physical training instructors. That went with a suitable audience, I understand, of various officers and such like. Never happened to me, but serious offences, like possibly a boy being caught stealing something, right up to the ultimate offence, official cuts. Only, I would think, administered a couple of times a year, perhaps.
Now, what about the daily routine? And perhaps look at the nature of the education and training you got. How would your day? What was a typical day's life?
It did vary by the seasons a little bit. Up at about, well, I guess about seven. I'm rather guessing now. into a cold plunge first, seawater, a big slate pool about 10 feet square and about 2 feet deep of cold seawater pumped straight up from Mill Creek down below the college. It's difficult ever to get used to that. I think there was some little effort made to heat them, only very little. Through the plunge, back in, dress, you're allowed 4 minutes. Down to breakfast, about 8 o'clock, I guess. A muster in the corridor, all lined up.
Can I just ask about the food generally, taking that out of the daily
work? Yes.
What was the food like compared to what you were used to at home?
Perfectly all right, really. Served from big wheel trolleys by little men. They all came rushing out of the kitchen of the galley at the end of the dining room, where we sat at long tables, one table per house. I don't know how long the tables were. They seemed to be enormous to me, but I suppose they're about, must have been about sort of 60 feet long. And at the moment the meal hour started, you had to be there. The doors were flung open, in rushed about six of these men with their trolleys servicing each line of tables. It was okay. In the winter, I think there was a very early sort of bun and cocoa served. But not I believe in the summer.
Okay, so after breakfast, you had an early morning muster.
Mustered by your houses in the long corridors of the building. Cadet Captain read out the names. I can still remember almost all the names because we heard it twice a day. Addison, Bennett, Bostock, Brigstock, Caswell, on and on and on. Eason, Ensel, Fairneyfell, about 40 names. Sir. And that was that over. And then divisions, sort of morning parade on the parade ground.
What would happen at divisions?
It was a little parade. Fell in by your houses and went through certain drills, marched off up around to your classes. Did an awful lot of marching at Dartmouth. And the band playing. Yes, morning colours, that was it. The culmination was the hoisting of the ensign at the flagstaff at the bottom of the parade ground. That's what it led up to. Then it all marched off. There was a guard of about, formed by each house in turn, a guard of about 20, who all had rifles. Had to do a lot of rifle drill.
Well, let's talk about drill. I mean, rifle drill and marching.
Yes.
How did you take to it? You hadn't had much experience of it, I presume, before.
No, well, any amount of instruction. There were men who I think would have been retired chief petty officers, probably. And they just taught you to march. With some, it seemed to come quite easily. With others, it was agony trying to break out of swinging your left arm with your left foot. I was always perfectly all right, but especially I suggest boys who had no sense of music in them, they simply couldn't get it at all, and were always getting along like ducks, you know. In the Sabbath, sorry.
Did you understand the point of drill at the time? Perhaps you do now, but did you understand then why you had to do so much drill and marching and rifle drill?
Possibly not. I think one must have done, really. You must have known that in your future years in the Navy, particularly in junior ranks, you will be doing this with platoons of sailors from your own ship. Yes, I think so.
Did you enjoy drill and the marching with the bands and everything?
I was not too bad at it. I think one enjoyed marching with the bands because one was with all one's term around one, and didn't enjoy rifle drill because I was a bit small and skinny, and the Enfield rifle was jolly hard on the shoulders. Thoroughly beastly. In the summer, particularly, there were always a certain number of feints going on. Boys would faint on parade. It happened to me once, that's all. It happened to my brother frequently, something it became for pathological. But didn't affect his career. We didn't, in fact, overlap. We were 5 years apart. And on Sunday divisions was dressed up, was altogether more important, and you're inspected by the captain and or perhaps a visiting admiral. And that was much more serious. And finally, had to do a march past at the end. March past the king at one. I remember once then, and Princess Elizabeth was with him. She was about our age, of course. The present queen, about two or three years younger than me, I think. No more than that. I'm 78 now. She's 72, is she? Yes, something like that.
Now, after the morning divisions, on a normal day, what would happen then?
Straight to classes.
What were the classes like?
In typical school studies, all parquet floors, rows of desks, in some cases specialised for the task. In other words, they sort of rising up from the front. Like you see pictures of university classes, but each one to accommodate, I suppose, something like 15 or 20 boys.
And what studies, what subjects were you studying in the classrooms?
You started perfectly conventionally, like any public school would start: maths, English, French, science, history. And English, I think, probably was it.
How did you do at those? Do you have any particular favourites?
I started very lowly. My prep school, I think, was as a means of teaching was probably abysmal. And I just scratched in, scraped into Dartmouth, but I may say that on the prize giving after about 2 years, I got a special prize for steady upward progress. I think I've still got it, and I finished up certainly in the top five, maybe top three, in my term. So I had it there, but had to recover from the appalling prep school.
Was there any subject you particularly liked?
Science was my best subject. Electricity, static, dynamics, chemistry, optics. Yes, I liked science. After about, there were 11 terms one did there. After about 6 terms, a big split took place. When you were either selected as a science alpha or literary alpha. Titles explain themselves, really. Or neither. They took the top half academically. I was selected as a science alpha. It was a bit dodgy because I never was very good at mathematics. But luckily, I had a great friend there, killed in the war, Waterall, who did my maths for me, or at least showed me how to do it. I couldn't have done without him. I wouldn't have survived in the alpha maths class without him. But that was fine.
So you specialised in science to a higher degree than the other two sections of the boys?
Science went with maths, yes. Literary was languages, one or two languages, French, I think optional German, and English. And yes, we were lifted out of them, separate classes. Every cadet had his tutor, one of the masters, and every week you met your tutor, and he'd obviously be briefed by the other masters and discussed you. And I remember him saying, "Eason, I strongly recommended you as a science alpha. I'm a bit worried about this," he said. "I'm not sure you're going to make the grade, but do have a go." That's how it happened.
So you'd be in classes in the morning. Would they all be educational classes in the morning, or would there be some seamanship?
No, they were increasingly became had to share the time with seamanship, which was either in the seamanship room practicing doing knots and splices with splendid old West Country retired chief and POs. "This here is a man rope knot," and that kind of thing, you know.
Could you explain about, I mean, knots and splices always seem strange now to people, why people were learning in 1938, 39, knots and splices. Could you tell me which knots and splices you were learning and perhaps why you thought you were devoting time to
that? Well, I think seamanship, ordinary practical seamanship on board any ship involves a constant use of knots and splices. And I think quite rightly they thought that a young officer supervising his ratings should know how to do them himself, and might indeed, running a boat, you were constantly practicing your knots, tying up, and that kind of thing. Absolutely essential, I think. Splices, similarly, repairing ropes, and wires, of course. Now, these were days before all these man-made fibres came along. It was purely hemp and manila. One got fairly good at it. Not as good as a practiced chief PO, but enough to get by and do one stuff, yes.
No, that's not some splices. What other aspects of seamanship?
They had big, very big models of, say, ships, battleships' forecastle. A big model of the Nelson or Rodney, I think it was, about 10 feet long, just the front part of the ship, with all the capstans and cable holders and slips and bollards and everything to scale, the chains and the ropes and the things. And there you learnt how to moor a ship, how to anchor a ship. There's an awful lot in this. If it's done wrong, you're going to kill people. The class just sat around in raised seating around the model while the instructor with his stick and actually did it on the model. And absolutely essential, that was. So when you went to your first ship, you knew what was going on.
Anything else? What else?
All the the drill and to do with hoisting and lowering boats, very important. They had model davits all rigged up with their ropes, and the hoisting and lowering of boats, as you can imagine, is a difficult business, especially at sea, and it all followed very, very strict drill. Again, if it didn't, you'd get any number of people killed and maimed. There were terrifically heavy weights involved. So you had to learn the drill, constantly practice it. Most of the power to raise and lower boats in those days was done by manpower. A whole line of seamen on what's called the falls, which are the ropes, lined up down the deck, and actually running away with the rope, and up came the boat. So it was a quick business. Nowadays it's all done with electric motors, but the old way was good because it was very fast. When you said hoist away, up it came quickly.
So it's hoisting and lowering boats. What other aspects of seamanship? Navigation or boxing the compass? Were you still required to do that, or were they using point system then?
That probably came into it, yes, but that was quite quickly learned. Navigation, quite a separate subject, treated academically. It was one of the classes, probably twice a week, where you had your navigation class, which took you right up from the theory of astronomical navigation, which is a theory of coping with the Earth not being flat very largely. So its own special form of trigonometry, spherical trigonometry. We learned all that, going right up to how to take your sights, your angles with the sextant of the sun and the stars, how to work out your results and produce the position. A lot of work involved.
Did your mathematical, you weren't bad at maths, but you weren't alpha at maths. Did that cause you any trouble in early on in navigation? Spherical trigonometry, for instance, sounds quite difficult.
Everybody had to do it, so I think it was all sort of by formula. I would think chaps like me, who are quite good at that, probably find it quite easy. Others probably not so.
So that's enough. What about practical boat work?
Yes, that was all carried out down on the River Dart. There was quite a comprehensive little boat harbour at Sandkey, with boats of several types. There were cutters, which were the full-sized oared boat carried in bigger ships. They were about 32 feet long, with big heavy oars, and required a big bloke to manage them. Cutters, whalers, 26 feet long, and gigs and skiffs, as it's in descending order of size, in which you did your pulling, the service term for rowing, and sailing as well. Learned to sail all those boats, and there were a large number of DODs, Dartmouth One Designs, small, single-sailed dinghies, beautiful little boats, about 12 feet long, which you could just crew, but normally by one chap, you could sail. And that went on every week with chief petty officer instructors.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes. I was never a really wild sailing man, but you couldn't really help enjoy it, especially in the summer, but it wasn't always summer, of course. I think